Well, if you have your outline with you, we have actually made a little progress. Last week we covered, or did I, should I say uncovered, tried to uncover a couple of verses in Deuteronomy chapter 1, working with God's reminder to the Israelites, it's time to head out, head north. We've spent enough time at this mountain. Let's get going. Our first text this morning, and I'm not sure how far we will get, but we'll see. Our first text is verses 9 to 12. Before they get going, Moses recalls some administrative procedures that he tried to enact among his people. In order to understand this text, though, we have to go back to Exodus chapter 18. Remember, Moses is remembering an event 38 years ago. Well, what's that event? Well, let's go back to chapter 18, and you will find that obviously there are some differences in Moses' recollections. But in his recollections, as we so often do, he's not trying necessarily to give us a precise reconstruction of chronological events as they happened. He is making a point. And so there will be some adjustments in the details. But in Exodus chapter 18, we have come through the Red Sea. Crossed the desert all the way down and arrived at Mount Sinai, where Moses has a reunion with his father-in-law, Jethro. Let's pick it up at verse 13. Moses has had a wonderful time inside his father-in-law's tent, recalling, giving testimony to the wonderful acts of God. And then in verse 10, Jethro says, "Blessed be the Lord." Notice, Lord here is all caps. Jethro is a Midianite. One of the functions of the signs and wonders associated with the Exodus was that the world may know that I am Yahweh. Well, here it's working. "Blessed be Yahweh, who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders to Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God." And of course, this is probably an extension of the covenant meal that they ate at Sinai. When you're in covenant relationship with somebody, you eat a meal. And so Jethro is buying into the covenant. That's how I interpret this. Well, perhaps that's what sets the appropriate stage for what happens next. "The next day, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing, as fathers-in-law are wont to do," son, it's not very smart, "what in the world is this that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge and all the people stand about you from morning till evening?" That's how fathers-in-law talk to their sons-in-law, don't they? "And Moses said, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me. I judge between a man and his neighbor, make known the statutes of God and his instructions. And Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you're doing is not good." This is stupid. Of course, the biblical text always has a way of softening really strong feelings. It's not good. This is stupid. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task, the job is far too heavy for you. You can't do it alone. Listen to me, and I'll give you some advice. And of course, our translations all have it, so I'll give you counsel. It is the word. But that's not how fathers-in-law talk to children. Let me counsel you. This is not a counseling situation. This is a father-in-law giving advice. I'll give you some a bit of advice. And God be with you. I love that. Because it's a reminder to us that in our work, we need always to be combining thinking. Use your head. And submission to the will of God. Those two things. And God be with you. So here, where are we? Listen to me, I'll give you counsel, God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God, but teach them the statutes and the laws and make known to them the way in which they are to walk. That's the biblical idiom for how to live. It's not whether to walk with your feet straight or happy hooligan, as my teacher unsaid, or pigeon-toed. It's not about walking. It's not about gait, G-A-I-T. It's about life. You teach them the way they are to walk and the work they are to do. Furthermore, select out of all the people able men. Now notice the qualities. Who fear God, men of truth, who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and tens. Let them judge the people regularly at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute, you don't have to micromanage this place. Let them do it, so it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, notice again, he's just giving him personal advice. If you do this thing and God so commands you, then you'll be able to endure and all these people will go to their place in peace. Well, that's the background. Now let's go to Deuteronomy. How does Moses remember this event? Deuteronomy 1, verse 9. I spoke to you at that time saying, I can't bear the burden of you alone. The Lord your God has multiplied you. And look, you are this day as the stars of the heaven for multitude. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you a thousandfold and more than you are, and bless you just as he has promised you. How can I alone bear the load and the burden of you and your bickering? Your translation probably has strife. Mine does. And your bickering. Choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. And you answered and said to me, that's a good idea. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and tens, and officers for your tribes. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, listen to the cases between your fellow countrymen. Judge righteously between a man and his fellow countrymen or the alien who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, bring it to me and I'll hear it. And I charged you at that time all the things that you should do. Well, there are a couple of interesting things about that. What do you know about, notice about some differences? Pardon me? The Midianite is omitted? Yes. How about the timing? In Exodus, that conversation happened when they arrived at Sinai. Well, this, it sounds like the Lord has just said, you've been at this mountain long enough. Time to get going. Oh, by the way, before we head out, let me reorganize the business so we make it. So it creates the impression that this happened just as they were leaving. But of course, don't push it. Don't force it. Critical scholars jump all over this and try and find and hear evidences of discrepancy and whatever. But this is what we do. when you're looking way back 38 years, the events all merge and they blur. He's not concerned about the order of events. He said, at that time, remember, before we headed out, and it's true, before we headed out, we reorganized everybody. So that's one thing to notice. Anything else that you notice here? We'll probably pick it up as we work our way through here. Well, no, the Midianite, Jethro, is left out of the picture. In fact, where's the initiative? I spoke to you at that time saying, I'm not able to bear the burden. What's the problem? Well, in the other one, Jethro says, Moses, this is stupid. You can't do it all yourself. And here Moses, he remembers, I can't bear the burden of you alone. This is the first thing to notice. A couple of things about this problem. First, the expression he uses. Turn to Numbers 14:27. Numbers 14:27. And we'll come back to this in the next episode. Numbers 14 is the narrative of how they arrived at Kadesh Barnea. And then from there they refused to go in. But what's the verse? 14:27. After they refused to go in, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard their complaints that they are making against me. That's not actually the verse that I wanted. I can't bear you alone. Where's this? Oh, I wrote down the wrong number. 14:27. Odd, I thought I had it here. Pardon me? You got Numbers 11:14. Did I do that? Yes, Numbers 11:14. Here you have it. Where am I? This is Moses talking. Where am I to get and give meat to all this people for they weep alone? I'm not able to carry all this people because it's too burdensome for me. But there's another place where the Lord is taken. Well, let's move on. The point is, Moses is quoting God's words back to him. At one point, the Lord said, I'm tired of their bickering. I'm tired of bearing this heavy load. Here Moses is saying, I can't do this. You guys are too heavy for me. That's the one side of the problem. Verse 9, that's the problem. But look at the reason for the problem, verse 10. On the one hand, the Lord has multiplied you, and look, you are this day as the stars of the heaven for multitude. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you 1,000 more than you are and bless you just as he has promised. But that creates a problem. The more God keeps his promise, the more tired I am. I can handle it. And so on the one hand, he is recognizing that God has been faithful. This is what he had promised he would do. He told Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, I will multiply your seed as the stars of the sky and the sand of the seashore. And that's where we are. And oh, that he would continue. But then notice the other side. This creates the dilemma. How can I bear the load and the burden of you and your strife, your bickering? Now Moses is getting very, very personal. This is the first hint that in this speech, he has become a sour old pastor. Complaining about his congregation. How can I do this, your bickering and your strife? That word for, the burden of you, this same expression is used elsewhere of an ox or a donkey loaded down under its weight. I have become a pack animal, we could say. I am just a jackass. That's what a jackass is. I have become a beast of burden, and you guys are so heavy on my back that I have fallen down. Somebody help me up. You have that in chapter 20. And so here then is his proposal, as the solution. So the solution, verses 13 to 17. First of all, he says, gives a proposal. Choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. Oh, wise and experienced and discerning. What did we read in the other text? Go back there. Jethro. And this is where Jethro's inspiration probably is evident. What did Jethro say? In verse 21, select out of all the people able men, yes, but who fear God, who have integrity, who hate dishonest gain. What's that about? Character counts. We've just come through an election. And in many instances, we were between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, one candidate has these character flaws. And on the other hand, the other candidate has the other character flaws. And so you're left to choose between a, somebody told it to me this way, a pathological liar or a criminal. It's probably overstatement on both counts, but hey, this is election rhetoric. That's what you do. And of course, so we're left choosing. Notice Jethro's emphasis is entirely on character, which is rather interesting. When we get to chapter 17, where Moses talks about the king, when you say, I'd like to set a king over myself, you may surely set a king over yourselves, one whom the Lord chooses. He shall not multiply for himself silver, for himself gold, for himself women. But this is what he shall do for himself. He shall write a copy of this Torah for himself in the presence of the priest, and it shall be with him like an amulet around his neck. And he shall read it all the days of his life that he sits on the throne, that he learn to fear the Lord his God and not walk to the right or to the left, and that he obey the Lord. Then he will have good success and sit long on the throne. That text doesn't say a thing about what kings do. Normally, a king's job is to lead in battle, to see to it that justice is done internally, and to build a temple for the god. Doesn't say anything about any of that. What is the king's job? To embody the values of the community. That's number one. And so Jethro's appealing for integrity here. But when you get to Moses, I think Moses is probably assuming this, although we have to remember this generation wasn't there. We're dealing with new people. But Moses' emphasis here is on his load. I need help. And so he says, choose wise, discerning, and experienced men from your tribes, and I'll appoint them as your heads. And you answered and said, this is the people's response, that's a good idea. Let's do that. But there was a hand back here. Yes? Well, of course, that becomes the paradigm by which the narrators later evaluate all the kings. And there are not many who do very well. So, but it is the paradigm for leadership then and today. All right, the people say, that's a good idea, let's do it. And so you have the implementation, verse 15. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands and hundreds, fifties, and officers of your tribes. and then you have Moses' charge. Actually, this is where the center of gravity is. Three verses now devoted to Moses' speech. This is his ordination speech. I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen. Judge righteously between a man and his fellow countrymen, or the alien who's with you. And of course, this notion of righteousness will become very important. The word tzedek here, it's the judgment of righteousness. The word tzedek means in accordance with the principles and the values and the revealed will of the covenant. So that you're always maintaining the covenant values. The interesting thing here is it's supposed to apply not just to your own people, but be sure the aliens experience the same commitment to righteousness that the outsiders do. It's an interesting little addition here. The aliens among you as well. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. Well, that's an interesting principle. You shall not show partiality. Turn to chapter 10. Where he's talking about how the Lord cares for the marginalized. Chapter 10, verse 17. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, the awesome God, who does not show partiality or take a bribe. He executes justice for orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. He does not show partiality. You know what the Hebrew expression here is? He doesn't lift the face. Well, what in the world is that? And of course, you have to imagine an Oriental court scene in which the king sits as judge, the ushers bring in the defendant, and he comes down and he bows prostrate before the king with his head to the ground, waiting for the verdict. He doesn't lift the face. He doesn't say first, stand up so I can see who you are, and then render the judgment. No, it's as if every defendant comes to him with a bag over his head. And we do not regard who this person is. There's no difference between the ones who are poor and the ones who are rich, the ones who have influence and the ones... That's what being impartial means. Not considering the face, that is, the identity of the person in front. Let the principles govern the case. Yes, sir. Yes? Well, that's it. I mean, we can talk nicely about that, can't we? But it raises interesting questions about how far from the biblical standards we are. Notice the commitment. The commitment is to righteousness. The commitment is not to favoring anybody, but doing what is right, no matter what. And so just because a person, with all due respect to you attorneys in the crowd, just because a person can hire a clever attorney should make no difference, zero difference, and the case itself will be handled rightly, righteously. So, you shall not show partiality, you shall hear the small and the great. And before you consider which cases you're going to try, don't put them on a scale and see who's heavier, which case is weightier. Where can I, as a judge, make a name for myself? winning the big ones. No, the small and the great absolutely alike. Oh, and by the way, don't fear men. Don't worry about what the Tribune will say or anybody else. Why not? You'll answer to God. The judgment, in the end, is God's judgment. And so, be careful. God is the ultimate adjudicator here. And if the case is too hard for you, bring it to me. I'll hear it. He is the ultimate court of appeal. So I commanded you at that time all these things that you should do. Well, any questions about this? Any lessons we have for life other than ones we've hinted at? And now, I suppose what we shouldn't do is point fingers. But look at ourselves. How am I doing? And so, you know, I try to teach at the college here. I say I try. When I was in the College of Education, they said, you haven't taught until people have learned. And in the end, I can't control whether they learn or not. So I try to teach. Sometimes I try to implement this by, and it's almost term paper time. Some of my students are here. Sometimes what I do is, you know, the term papers all have a title page. I take off the title page. I give it a code number and put it on that number so that I get them right at the end. But I take off the title page and then read every paper blind. Because some of the students, I've got about 42 or 43 registered students in my Old Testament theology class. Some of these students I know a lot better than others. We have lunch or supper before, it's a night class. So anybody who's available, we have supper in the cafeteria with people in the class. You want to come? I've got to get know a lot, you know, a dozen of these people rather well, and it's a delight, that conversation. Now, for those who can't make the dinner, are they going to be disadvantaged when it comes to me grading papers? That's always a danger. And how do I fight that? Righteousness must prevail so that an A is always an A. And a C is always a C, no matter whose paper it is. It's a practical way in which we have to struggle with the issue. How about you? Some of you. How do you work with this? Give us some illustrations. It's not what you know, it's whom you know. See, that little phrase here, for the judgment belongs to the Lord. That is so helpful. Ultimately, it's not the curry I favor with the people over whom I have power, but it's how, with what kind of integrity God sees me operate. Anybody, there's another hand here somewhere I saw. Any other questions you want to raise? Yes, sir.
Well, as a practical matter, this is why the third world is the third world, at least in my opinion. Because the leadership there
Exactly. I mean, you go to Greece or Russia. Ellen and I went to Russia in 1993 for the first time to teach over there for, well, almost 2 months, I guess. And we were living in Minnesota at the time. We got to the airport, and there one of our good friends who is an executive in Cargill. He was at the airport as well, and he knew we were headed over there, and he gave us each $20. And then he said, remember, anything under $20 isn't a bribe. You know, as a Christian, how do you deal with it? It creates all kinds of dilemmas, because you've got to carry on a righteous agenda. But in order to facilitate it, there are two economies. There's the one above the table and the one below the table. God's people, in principle, operate above the table rather than under, and especially in the administration of justice. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Hey, you do what you need to do sometimes. I mean, I'm sure all of us have done this. When I was in university, I did first of all an education degree and then an arts degree. But in my education program, I took a course from a certain professor who will remain unnamed. He was an awful teacher. But he was high up in the college. I never missed a class. I sat in the front row. Later on, years later, when we were headed overseas to do my doctoral work, I needed a letter of reference for a Canadian government grant. Whom did I ask? This person who had been a rather pathetic teacher. But hey, it's not what you know, it's whom you know. And God in His mercy looked favorably upon us. But that is the way. I think it's rather important for us to read a text like this for ourselves. Don't read it first for others. Every one of us has influence at some level. How do we handle these matters? Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. 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 Well, that's exactly. I mean, you've set the stage for something else we'll see later on in this chapter. But somewhere along the line, I think I have tried to reconstruct how it actually went. And, you know, on the one hand, they seem to contradict, but you can reconstruct the issues so that it actually does fit together. And but yes, you're right that the impetus for this seems to come from different directions. I think there's actually a back and forth. It could well be Jethro says this, Moses talks to the people about it, and the people say, and then he goes back to God, and God approves it, and you know, so we'll find the same kind of thing happening when we look at the scout story, sending out the spies. Of course, Moses is preaching. Moses says, it's 38 years. What is the point he's trying to make? That's what we need to be asking. And his point is not, I'm trying to give you an exact reconstruction of how things happened. And we all know that's not realistic. You don't do that. You don't, if that's not what your goal is, You don't worry about those things, and Moses isn't worrying about those things either. Yes, sir. Well, that's interesting. The point she's making is Moses is becoming himself again as he was when God first called him. He didn't want to do it. And I think in his old age, some of those things come back. But you will notice, though, as we get through the book, if we get any farther than chapter 2, once we're out of this first speech, Moses is a different person. This first speech is then so autobiographical, and you get a realistic picture of what it means to lead stubborn people. And Moses, as he will say, is bitter because the people have prevented him from finishing the mission. And so that's in the back of his mind, I think, over and over again. Well, let's go to the next phase then. We bring our map back for verse 19. Then we set out from Horeb, and we went through all that great and terrible desert which you saw. Great and terrible. These are interesting expressions that he uses for the desert that they're traipsing through. It's great because it's massive, it's big, there's space here. Your dog runs away, and 3 days later, you can still see him. It's like Saskatchewan, this great and terrible desert. But the other thing is, it's terrible. It's a scary place. Elsewhere, he will talk about why it's scary. It's scary because there's no water, there's no food, there are scorpions, there are snakes. You never know what you're going to step on. But we made it. He led you through that great and terrible desert, which you saw. Now, of course, now I think we're back to this generation. You guys have seen the desert. On the way to the hill country of the Amorites, actually, most of these guys hadn't yet seen it. They saw it later. On the way to the hill country of the Amorites, just as the Lord our God commands, and we came to Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea, that's up here. It's a very critical turning point in their history. They've come down here just to recollect for those who weren't here last year. They've made it to Sinai, where for 15, 16 months the Lord has been entering into covenant relationship. This is their marriage festival and the honeymoon and all everything all together. And then God says, it's time to go head north, and they come to Kadesh Barnea. Normally that's an 11-day journey for traders and merchants, and Numbers 34 gives us lots of stopping places, or 33, and they get to Kadesh Barnea, and everybody should have been excited. We're there! And undoubtedly, Moses was very excited. I brought you out of I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land. We finally made it. It's interesting that he uses one verse to talk about that, the whole journey from here to there. Exactly. I'm sure there were lots of stories he could tell, but hey, we're moving on. And I said to you, now again, Moses is recalling his challenge. We gathered at Kadesh Barnea and we had an assembly, and I stood up in front of you and I gave you this address. Here's what I said to you. You have come to the hill country of the Amorites that the Lord our God is giving to us. See, the Lord our God has placed the land before you. Go up and take possession, for as the Lord, the God of your fathers has spoken to you, don't fear or be dismayed. This is a rousing speech. We are there. What are we going to do? And in this, he tries to encourage them. It's actually the same kind of speech he will give to Joshua. Be of good courage. Don't let your hands become limp. Take courage because we're about to enter the promised land. Notice what he says about the land. The land, it's the hill country of the Amorites, but it's the one the Lord is about to give to us. He has placed it before you. Notice who put it there? God. This is not our accomplishment. So take possession what God has given you and fulfill the promise to the ancestors. Don't fear. Don't worry. Don't get, come unglued. The word for be dismayed here is actually to be shattered. Don't come unglued over the stress that's about to hit you. And of course, we have to back up and ask ourselves, what is the point of all of this? Here, what Moses is doing in his charge, he is setting the context for what's about to happen. He's just giving us some background information. It's against this background, against my challenge to you, against the recollection of all that God has done to us and what God is about to do, that's what we're about, that's the mission is about to be fulfilled. Well, what happens? Then all of you approached me and said, let's send men before us that they may scout. Now, we always talk about these people as spies, but of course, our understanding of the word spies, this is not James Bond. These are scouts, which normally, and we've got lots of extra-biblical references to these kinds of scouts, where before an army attacks another people, they'll send scouts to get some information, so that they may develop strategy, perhaps see where the weak points are that we need to attack. Let's send scouts that we may search out the land and bring back to us the word of the way by which we should go up. That, I think, has to do with strategy. And the cities we should enter. What's the problem with the way in which they put that? How shall we handle this? And which cities we should attack?
You send scouts out if you're ignorant.
Exactly. It's as if this is a human task. This is why it's so important that when Joshua takes the people across the Jordan River, what's the first thing that happens on the other side? Who shows up? The commander of the Lord of hosts. Yes. To remind Joshua, who's in charge? Trust me, I'll lead you. And here, there's nothing about that here. Which way we should go up in the cities? And Moses says, Moses responds, that's a good idea. So I took 12 of your men, one from each tribe, and they turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol, and they scouted the place out. I said, that's a great idea. Now let's go back to Numbers 14. Numbers 14. Well, actually, we'll pick it up in 13. The end of chapter 12 again. Afterwards, the people moved out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. This is just across the, in the vicinity of Kadesh Barnea. The Lord said to Moses, saying, send out for yourself men so that they may scout out the land of Canaan, which I am about to give the sons of Israel. Send a man from each of the tribes, every one leader among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord. Notice the emphasis. At the command of the Lord. At the command of the Lord. And all of the men who were heads of the sons of Israel, and these are their names, when Moses sent them out to spy out the land of Canaan, he said, go up into the Negev, go up into the hill country, see what the land is like, whether the people live there are weak or strong, whether they are few or many, and how is the land in which they live? Is it a good land? How are the cities? Are they like other open camps or with fortifications? How's the land? Fat or lean? Are there troops, trees or not? Make an effort to, you know, this is taking a survey. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Tzin as far as Rehov to Libo Hamath. And when they had gone up, they came to Hebron and so on. It's a little different procedure here again. So on the one hand, it's remarkable how transparent Moses is. On the one hand, he says, you guys, you said, let's go up so that we can plan our strategy. And on the other hand, he says, you know, I thought that was a good idea. Is he admitting something here? But notice the emphasis in their request is different from the emphasis in God's. When God sent them out, according to Numbers, it was simply to scout out the place. Get a feel for the land that God is giving us. I think that's the point. Later on in Deuteronomy, in chapter 8, Moses will say, the Lord gave you this land with cities that you didn't build, vineyards and or groves that you didn't plant, cisterns you didn't dig. So the point is the resources that God is delivering into the hands of the people. That's the emphasis. When Moses recalls it now, you know what he remembers? This was a horizontal affair rather than a vertical affair. And he was a part of the problem. And they turned and went to the hill country. They came to the valley of Eshkol and scattered it out. And they brought some of the fruit of the land back in their hands. They brought it back and here's the report they gave. It's a wonderful land, which the Lord our God is about to give us. That's the government report. And it is so true. And it is still so true for us. That which God plans for His people is good. That which He gives His people is good. And it's all grace. It's the gift. It's a gift that the Lord promised to the ancestors. Later on, He'll use the word nachala, which is usually translated inheritance. No, it's the grant.